going to have an intense hour tonight. Good evening and welcome to Wednesday night to Health With You, right here on the Edge of Darkness. What I'm about to share with you is one of many articles that I published on Dr. Kelly's website since the year 2000. As a matter of fact, what I'm about to share with you is very brief, and it's right to the point. It was originally published by me September 27th of the year 2000. And it dealt with the misuse of prescription drugs to control supposed out-of-control children. Now, we have a category, as you may know of, on the drkelly.net called A Spoonful of Sugar. And in this particular case, it relates more to the dietary habits, which seem to have a greater effect on these children. Now, as a former assistant scoutmaster of a Boy Scout troop, which seemed to draw more of its fair share of ADD, ADHD diagnosed children, the common denominator in their homes was bowls of sugar, candy, cookies, cakes, pies, every kind of dessert imaginable, but poor overall dietary habits, many of which were mirrored in our frequent troop camping trips. You know, don't forget the Cheetos and the M&Ms. What about the doctors? Well, they seem to dispense this stuff as if it were candy. Back in that time period, the New York court ordered the use of medicine. Public schools were accusing parents of child abuse when they balk at giving their kids drugs like Ritalin and Prozac, and the judges began to agree. Some parents were medicating their children for fear of having them hauled away. And it became an emerging twist in the growing debate about diagnosing and medicating children with ADD and ADHD. An Albany, New York couple put their 7-year-old son back on Ritalin after a family court ruled that they must continue medicating him for ADD. Now, if you remember some months ago, we did a very intense piece that I'd written about my years going to high school and how we began to become familiar with things like ADD and ADHD, although they weren't called that at that point in time. Well, back to New York. So Child Protective Services visits another New York couple to check out anonymous allegations of medical neglect because they took their son off Ritalin and other drugs because of side effects, the couple said. This is relatively new, but it's happening. That, according to Maryland psychiatrist Peter Bregan, who was aware at that time of similar cases in Boston. Often, he said, divorced parents disagree on medicating their children. Judges recently have ruled in favor of the parent who wants to medicate. And the Albany case was the first pitting educators against parents that progressed to a judge's ruling. Psychologist Peter Jensen, who was on the board of Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Disorder at the time, said, this is going to be happening more and more. Now, children and adults with attention deficit disorder, I don't even know if they're still around, was a parents group that advocates combining drug and behavioral treatments. As many as 3.8 million school children at that time were diagnosed with ADD/ADHD, that according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. And at least 2 million of them took Ritalin, a stimulant for symptoms such as inattentiveness, impulsivity, and sometimes hyperactivity. In other words, the kids are bored with what's going on in the school system. But there were others, there were others that were treated with different drugs. Research then showed that medication improves the abilities of ADHD children. It's becoming increasingly clear that this is a powerful treatment that can be life-saving for some children, according to Jensen. The risk for severe ADHD is going untreated is not trivial. But the question became, should parents be forced to put their children on drugs? The long-term effects of children taking stimulants had not been studied at that time. Psychology professor William Frankenberger, who had studied ADD/ADHD at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire for more than 20 years, said that it was disturbing to take a decision like that out of parents' hands. This particular piece, which was titled, "Is Your Doctor a Serial Killer?" was written by Karen Thomas for USA Today before it became more of a entertainment publication. We published this on September 27th of the year 2000. But you see, these kind of stories don't end. Because I am convinced, my friends, and in full agreement with a surgeon that I know of, not by name. The surgeon begins by saying he was once proud of his profession. And he spent over 40 years as a clinician, an educator, and a researcher, and for most of that time thought he was engaged in a noble calling. But all that has changed in the past 3 years. Medicine is lost in the wilderness. Oh, there were warning signals, to be sure, he said. For many years, he was heavily involved in medical associations on the local, the state, the national levels. Gradually, he became disillusioned when he saw that many of his colleagues who gravitated to this activity did not share the surgeon's views. Oh, they enjoyed the politics of medicine. In fact, they enjoyed it too much. Our author lost interest. Perhaps in retrospect, that was part of the problem. The policy of medicine gradually became the politics of medicine. And was often was the case, where there is politics, there is also corruption. 20 years ago, our author, the surgeon, was appointed as a technical advisor to a panel of the federal government. And he was flown to Washington, D.C., housed in an upscale hotel and dined on fancy meals. And he saw how intoxicating power could be. And he began to somehow consider that he was special. The problem was that he was expected to use his technical expertise to advise in a certain way. And he realized, almost too late, what was going on. But he did realize it and was not reappointed to that position. And yet, looking back on it, that experience gave him a taste of how the events of the previous 3 years had come to be. This past 3 years, he saw how money and power and flattery could cause physicians to shade their recommendations. It happened oh so gradually until one day integrity was completely lost. The tragedy is that many times those who lost it never missed it. And our surgeon came to realize that ethics and medicine have parted ways for many physicians. Things that they once took for granted are gone, evaporated. And they'd reached a point where relating to COVID, attempts to treat disease were not just ignored, but penalized. As a surgeon, our author had operated under the obligation of giving informed consent to all of his patients. But he was expected to clearly explain the risks, the benefits, the alternatives of his proposed course of action and allow the patient to make the decisions regarding their response to those recommendations. He could be sanctioned for failing in that obligation. However, in COVID, informed consent was criminalized, but only for that disease. Those who still felt an obligation to their patients were and continue to be vilified, slandered, fired from their positions, and in some cases prosecuted. You know, one would have thought that organized medicine and academic medicine in particular would have rallied to their defense, but that was not the case. They were the primary prosecutors. And our author shook his head when he He shakes his head when he thinks back to the days that he taught medical ethics to residents and medical students. And one of the case studies involved discussing how accepting a lunch or even a pen from a drug company was unethical. Somehow individuals who made life and death decisions were suspected of being bribed by a pen. And owning stock in a company and prescribing medications manufactured by that company were absolutely forbidden. Now where are we? A good deal past the use of pens, for sure. When I was reading this article the other day and preparing it for publication at drkelly.net, there was a reader's comment that really struck me by Michelle Kersey. She said, "I have worked in healthcare for 33 years in small independent pharmacies and for 10 years now, a major healthcare entity in New Jersey. I am not privy to most behind-the-scenes machinations, but you'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to see how the public was utterly manipulated during the COVID pandemic. And they are revving it up again. The suppression of the use of medications that were readily available and inexpensive was beyond comprehension. And those medications worked." Michelle Kersey had a friend in the earliest days of COVID saved by hydroxychloroquine. Conversely, her brother was treated with a suspect protocol, and he's no longer with us. Lost at the age of 52. If anyone for 1 minute thinks it wasn't about profits from novel treatments and rushed vaccines, that you were sadly mistaken. Ethics are truly a relic of the past. How very sad, Michelle Kersey ends. Our author continues, the surgeon, "If a physician from even 10 years ago would look at the contents of most of our medical journals today, I am sure that he or she would think they were reading fiction." I'm going to give you the titles of four articles that make up what's known as the viewpoint section of the September 19th, 2023 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. People, this is not even, what, 2.5 weeks ago? Article number one, affirmative action ruled unconstitutional. Options for building a diverse healthcare workforce. Article number two, the Supreme Court's ruling on race neutrality threatens progress in medicine and health. Article number three, the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action, fewer black physicians and more health disparities for minoritized groups. Headline number four, article number four, holistic admissions at UC Davis, journey toward equity. In order to truly understand the departure from what was the norm a mere 10 years ago, we provide a link to the contents of the viewpoint section in the September 18th, 2013 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. Article 1, the HIPAA conundrum in the era of mobile health and communications. Article 2, a trial-based approach to statin guidelines. Number 3, Medicare payment for chronic care delivered in a patient-centered medical home. And number 4, PEPFAR's anti-prostitution pledge, spending power, and free speech intentions. The difference in the tenor of the articles is striking, at least to our author, the surgeon. In the current articles, the author's primary focus seems to be finding ways to circumvent the rule of law. In 2013, the two articles that dealt with legislative focus explore how to comply with the rule of law. And while some may claim that that is a distinction without a difference, our surgeon disagrees. "Something has changed," he says. "Oh, change is inevitable, but it's always positive. Is it? Looking back on history, many nations have changed in response to internal and external pressure. Unfortunately, the majority of those changes have been negative. Back in 2019, before the great COVID disaster, Baffi and Associates warned of a change that was occurring in medical and scientific publishing. And they observed the concentration of medical and scientific publishing in the hands of a few very large corporations, which answered to the stakeholders with conflicting interests. Here's what they stated. Because the use of complex digital tools and rapidly growing electronic databases require advanced computing skills, internet-based mega companies such as Google in Mountain View, California, Amazon, Seattle, Washington, and Facebook in Menlo Park, California, and Apple, Cupertino, California, may become interested in spearheading further transformation and out-compete current stakeholders in scholarly communications and develop more user-friendly tools. Such developments could potentially lead to a few large entities controlling the gateways to scientific knowledge. A sobering thought. You see, our surgeon continues, scientific publishing has been a highly profitable industry. There's little doubt that financial interests will continue to drive its transformation. And yet, the academic community has a fundamental stake in this process and should understand the trajectories of change to protect enduring values, embrace promising developments, and make scholarly communication increasingly inclusive and efficient. As you see, it would seem that the authors were amazingly prescient. As their world has come to pass, medicine seems, at least to me, our author continues, to have become the willing servant of an unholy trinity of big pharma, big tech, and big politics. Medical publication and medical education have become more interested in ideology and propaganda than healing, more interested in class than the individual. It is the very antithesis of the concepts contained in the Hippocratic Oath. Although the proponents of the transformation may claim it's being done for the greater good, that excuse has been used before in medicine and some nations of the last century. And when sanity returned, that excuse was repudiated. And so, my friend, society now finds itself a passenger on a ship which has been taken over by ideologues. The ship is heading for the rocks. Lookouts stationed high above can see the disaster unfolding and urgently inform the captain of the ship. The captain solves the problem by throwing the lookouts overboard. My friends, this is the dystopian world in which we now live. Signed, the surgeon. I know the surgeon's name. I was blown away when I read this thing. I don't know the surgeon, but I know his name. I will be in contact. Now, we have spent 20 minutes covering this first segment, including opening music. I want to take you down a different path. Let's talk a little bit about cancer. The cancer facts that Big Pharma is now aggressively claiming are myths. As I've continued to work on a series of things on drkelly.net and going back and reviewing some pieces, I've come across some pieces that are where we're worth going back and revisiting. What I'm going to attempt to share with you for the balance of this hour was published on drkelly.net on December the 8th, 2015. Now, I don't know, maybe you can go back, maybe I've got it archived, I don't care. All of this comes together for so many reasons. Think about the things that we've just talked about with the surgeon and the ADD, ADH business. And now we look at this title, Five Cancer Facts That Big Pharma Is Now Aggressively Claiming Are Myths. You see, according to the conventional wisdom, the article begins, of mainstream medicine, the world's leading health practitioners in alternative, complementary, and integrative medicine have it all wrong. That means Dr. Kelly was all wrong, and Nick Gonzalez was all wrong, and how many names throughout history that were all wrong, huh? And all these people were misinforming millions in practice and on the internet with a barrage of myths and misconceptions they claim are causing more harm to cancer patients. Could this initiative to sway opinion by leading cancer authorities possibly, just possibly, be related to a revolution that is happening around the world? Highlighting the dangers and ineffectiveness of toxic chemotherapy and radiation. Bringing cancer cures such as cannabis to the forefront. Or the emerging mass markets now creating awareness on the reality of our food and the consequences of the cancer industry itself. And so we're going to share some of these facts with you tonight. Fact number one. The rise in all types of cancers are due to our modern society diets, our lifestyles, our environment. But here's why the cancer industry claims this is a myth. They claim that it is our genes that are responsible. I don't mean, you know, blue jeans. We're talking G-E-N-E-S. And all that's combined, of course, with the fact that people are living long enough now to develop cancer because of our success in tackling infectious diseases and malnutrition that we now get cancer. It's perfectly normal for DNA damage in our cells to build up as we age, and such damage can lead to cancer developing. I mean, cancer has existed as long as humans have. That, according to the so-called medical cancer industry. But here's the reality. The only reason that people around the world today believe that our ancestors did not live past 100 years is because the official data has been sparse. There's very few records that show officially the age of our ancestors before the 18th century. But there's a reasonable amount of evidence suggesting that there were many people living hundreds of years in prehistory and beyond. In all the skeletons collected in the history of paleoanthropology, scientists have only been able to identify a mere 200 possible cancer sightings dating to prehistoric times. And those identifications are far from certain. And despite the numbers, when you look at the remains, it seems to indicate that malignancies were a striking rarity in ancient times, but that evidence is hardly conclusive. We just don't know for sure. So to use any type of argument that cancer existed or did not exist to any extent in prehistory involves making an awful lot of assumptions. So let's just focus on what has transpired in the last century alone. According to the U.S. National Center for Health Statistics, vital statistics of the United States from the early 1900s alone up to and including 2011, there was a greater than threefold increase in cancer death rates. And according to a 2013 featured report compiled by the American Cancer Society and other government and cancer advocacy groups, progress had been made in the war on cancer. But what kind of progress? Declining mortality rates were not due to decreases in incidence. More people were getting cancer, but they were staying alive longer. And what the cancer industry does not point out is that the trends clearly show that we have not eliminated cancer to any extent, but we've managed to be able to diagnose it and treat it, and thus profit from the actual disease itself. People globally are living longer, but chronic debilitating conditions are becoming more prevalent. Diagnosis and treatment are the moneymakers in this industry. Diagnosis and treatment are the moneymakers in this industry. Actual prevention is not. When it comes to prevention, conventional medicine has stuck its head in the sand. or up there. Well, you get it. Overall, cancer deaths began to drop in the 1990s, with death rates declining by 1.8% for men and 1.4% for women between the years 2000 and 2009. That, according to a featured report. Children's death rates from cancer were also declining at a pace of 1.8% per year, although incidence is still rising by about 0.5% annually. Other cancers were also still on the rise, though, including liver, pancreatic cancer, and melanoma among men. Pancreatic cancer is the worst form to get. The chances of surviving it and becoming healthy again are very slim if you follow the mainstream medical protocol, something William Donald Kelly did not do, and cured himself of pancreatic cancer and lived for a good number of years beyond that and helped many, many other people overcome their pancreatic cancer as well. A 2008 study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science demonstrated how nutrition alone can have a tremendous impact, not only on prevention, but even on the treatment of cancer once you've been diagnosed. Now, that's nutrition. That's Dr. Kelly's other book, The Self-Test for the Different Metabolic Types, which gets very deeply involved with the nutritional aspect of things. His other book, now titled Victory Over Cancer Without Surgery, Chemotherapy, or Radiation. Both of these books are available through Kettle Moraine. All you got to do is go to Dr. Kelly's website, drkelly.net. And up at the top, it says, underneath the title, it says, Home, Welcome, The Mission, Dr. William D. Kelly, His Story. Dr. Kelly's metabolic typing, it's not the test, but it gives you a rough idea what you're dealing with as far as the nutritional things that different types of people should be eating. The Kelly Enzymes and the bookstore. Hold your mouse over the bookstore. You can either order the package or you can order individual books. By the way, Friday I'm picking up a new load. I'm only got a couple copies of each left, and I got to go and get some more printed. So keep in mind all of this stuff we've shared with you and the kind of stuff that Kelly and Gonzalez and other people shared with their victims, not patients, victims. All this type of information is never emphasized by the medical community because they do not believe cancer can be treated without either cutting, poisoning, or burning cancerous tumors. Fact number two, superfoods and herbs can prevent cancer. Of course, the cancer industry claims that's a myth. The claim is that specific fruits and vegetables that you choose don't really matter. There's no such thing as a superfood or medicinally powerful herb, and any assertion has no scientific basis. But here's the reality. And this one is just embarrassing for them, the medical community. While there is not one superfood or herb that may cure all cancers, to suggest that superfoods don't exist or that herbs are not medicinally powerful is reaching deep into the pits of ignorance. In fact, there's so much evidence that superfoods exist and have anti-cancer properties that any claim suggesting the opposite, just a good measure of where the credibility lies among many of these industry quacks that make such preposterous statements. As of December of 2015, the American Cancer Society, ACS, appeared to have removed references to superfoods or superfoods off their website. And yet a number of authors had written extensively about previous recommendations of the ACS, specifically regarding the potential of superfoods to prevent cancer. Northridge Hospital Medical Center listed several superfoods using the ACS as a source. CalorieLab.com posted a superfood infographic also using ACS as a source. But information on superfoods on the ACS website does not appear to exist. Oh, but keep this in mind. The pharmaceutical industry does not create cures. They create customers. Cancer research in the UK also discredits and discourages the use of superfoods. And on their page, it states you should not rely on so-called superfoods to reduce the risk of cancer. And the superfoods are unlikely to give you added health benefits over and above what you would get from eating a varied and healthy diet. But you see, my friends, one irritating problem that confuses the public is that most dietitians have no foundation of practical knowledge in nutrition. They propagate mainstream opinion on the validity of the food pyramid, that bread and cereal and grains should be the mainstay of our diets, and that fruits and vegetables are all equal. Most dietitians don't use the term superfood because they're not taught what superfoods are in school. The only thing they're taught is that superfoods are non-medical terms popularized in the media to promote unsupported health-promoting properties in foods. Well, a superfood can be summed up as any multitasking food with higher than average concentrations of disease-fighting nutrients, which are usually in abundance among the antioxidant and phytonutrient-rich profiles. And some suggest they are also low in calories, but that does not always apply to all superfoods. But there are some superfoods like blueberries. Blueberries just stand out above all the rest. Out of over 400 compounds analyzed, red grapes and blueberries are tops in boosting your immunity. Even WebMD.com, a very pro-mainstream medical website, by the way, lists 10 everyday superfoods. And here's the foods that they list. Broccoli, berries, quinoa, beans, nuts, eggs, and others, which few can deny are very nutrient-dense foods with anti-cancer properties. And look, it's not necessary to spend any large sums of money for heavily promoted superfoods such as Nonier, Acai, and Magostine, and other juices in an attempt to prevent cancer. The top six foods with the highest antioxidant values on the ORIC, or oxygen radical absorbance capacity scale, are cheaper and more readily available than the more expensive alternatives, and they are all proven to prevent cancer. And they include things like cloves, sumac, cinnamon, sorghum, oregano, and turmeric. And we have published at drkelly.net a very sizable number of articles about turmeric. Think about this. Extracts of black, red, and white sorghums have strong anti-proliferative activity against human cancer cells. Studies on animals with lung and skin cancer show that eugenol in cloves can stop cancer cells from multiplying. Clove oil extract was found in one study to have maximal cytotoxic activity on cancer cells. As a matter of fact, there's 17 herbs and spices which in their own right are considered superfoods that have been scientifically proven to prevent and treat cancer. Oh, that's right. There's another healing plant, considered one of the most powerful healing plants in the world, and has the ability to make cancer essentially disappear. It's called cannabis. Of course, cancer societies would certainly like cannabis to disappear because there's so much evidence that it prevents cancer. Dozens of studies which prove cannabis cures cancer. You can go do a quick search on PubMed for cannabinoid. Will yield 18,000 results. Now that's based on when this article I'm sharing with you was originally published, which wasn't yesterday. It was December 8th of 2015, my friends. You see, The reason cancer societies are now turning their heads to the power of superfoods and herbs is because they work. So they got to try and sway opinion in an attempt to convince millions who are now converting back to nature to prevent and cure disease. I guess the one thing you can say about cannabis, and personally, I've never cared for it. I've tried it exactly 5 times in my life. Pass. But there are those who believe that there's nothing better than being high on life. Fact number 3. Acidic diets cause cancer. Of course, the cancer industry claims that's a myth. They claim it's biological nonsense, according to the cancer industry. The pH of the blood is tightly regulated by the kidneys within a very narrow and perfectly healthy range. It cannot be changed for any meaningful amount of time by what you eat. There is no evidence to prove that diet can manipulate whole body pH or that it has an impact on cancer. The reality, my friends, is part of the problem with this notion is that there has been a lot of misinformation spread around by so-called health gurus and trade shows attempting to convince people that you can make dramatic shifts in the pH of your body through foods and alkaline water. Truth is, you can't make huge shifts in blood alkalinity or acidity, but you can make small shifts that are significant enough to reverse cancer. For you see, the pH of your blood is tightly regulated by a complex system of buffers that are continuously at work to maintain a range of 7.3 to 7.41, which is slightly more alkaline than pure water. If the pH of your blood falls below 7.3, the result is a condition called acidosis, a state that leads to central nervous system depression. Severe acidosis, where blood pH falls below 7, can lead to a coma and even death. If the pH of your blood rises above 7.45, the result is alkalosis. So the bottom line is that if you're breathing and going about your daily activities, your body is doing an adequate job of keeping your blood pH somewhere between 7.3 to 7.41. And the foods that you are eating are not causing any wild deviations of your blood pH. However, keeping your body closer to an alkaline state by even a few points up, 0.05, can make a significant difference in how well cancer grows or suppresses. You see, cancer cells cannot live in an alkaline environment. And so the reason acidosis is more common in our society is mostly due to the typical American diet, which is far too high in acid-producing animal products like meat and dairy, far too low in alkaline-producing foods like fresh vegetables. Additionally, we eat acid-producing processed foods like white flour and sugar and drink acid-producing beverages like coffee and soft drinks. We use too many drugs, which are acid-forming. And we use artificial chemical sweeteners like NutraSweet and Equal or Aspartame, which are all extremely acid-forming. One of the best things we can do to correct an overly acidic body is to clean up the diet and the lifestyle. Dr. A. Keith Brewer explained that in alkaline environments and high pH conditions, the acid toxins of the cancer cell are neutralized and rendered non-toxic. Acidic toxins, and not the tumor lump per se, is what brings about the death of the host. In the high pH condition, the life of the cancer cell is short. The dead cancer cells are readily absorbed by the system and eliminated. And Dr. Brewer says, I'm convinced that it is food that causes cancer, but it is the food we don't eat and not the food we do eat. And these conditions force the body to borrow minerals, including calcium, sodium, potassium, and magnesium, from vital organs and bones to buffer or neutralize the acid, safely remove it from the body. And once a person is diagnosed with cancer, the most effective way of reversing said disease is to move towards an alkaline diet and shift blood pH towards that 7.41 range, which is accomplished most effectively with raw fruits and vegetables, daily greens, which maximize phytonutrients and enhance the immune system's potential to reverse cancer. No. The body will not dramatically shift blood pH, but it does not need to for cancer cells to die. Even a small shift will reverse cancer and prevent the body from borrowing minerals from organs and bones to compensate for a nutritionally deficient diet. That's where alkalizing agents come in. Our author tells us that he's seen stage 4 cancer patients with tumors the size of footballs recover using alkalizing agents. And it's beyond the scope of what we can share with you on this program to explain how alkalizing agents and pH therapy can eliminate cancer. And yet, if you seek the assistance of any naturopathic physician well-versed in cancer treatment, the protocols are fairly common, although inconsistent. If you have a need for referrals to said physicians, I do invite you. Number one, several things. Do order copies of Dr. Kelly's book. And I must share with you, if you're already undergoing cancer treatment, you've been diagnosed, the self-test book unto itself will not help you. Kelly assigned a specific diet for the cancer victim to follow. Once you have been diagnosed free of cancer, then you can begin working with the rest of that book. Victory over cancer is an extension and a cleanup of the previous two titles that Dr. Kelly made. The first one, of course, was One Answer to Cancer, which then was altered One Answer to Cancer with Cancer Cure, and later came out Cancer Curing the Incurable. That book had problems. All of that's been corrected by me because I had the full knowledge taught to me by Kelly, and I also had the proper versions of the book to remeld back together. The bottom line, my friends, is that the body can achieve the metabolic accomplishment of keeping blood pH towards the alkaline spectrum where cancer will not proliferate. The immune system can then thrive, signal recovery, which is facilitated through nutritional mechanisms, alkalizing agents to maximize recovery and make treatments such as chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery completely unnecessary. And that is how it should be. Now, I will share with you right now, there is a good chance that I will not be able to complete this entire article. It's amongst the reasons I'm kind of speeding up my entire presentation, but maybe we can do it. The other thing I began to mention is if you are needing referral to specific people who were trained by Kelly, trained by Gonzalez, and you need some referrals, do contact me at 602-799-8214. I will be more than happy to connect you. I don't get a dime for it. That was never my goal. Fact number 4, sugar feeds cancer. Of course, the cancer industry claims that this is a myth. They claim that there's no evidence that cancer cells use glucose and produce energy in a different way from healthy cells. The sugar feeds cancer myth distorts sensible dietary advice, which must be based on nutritional and scientific fact. Except, my friends, the reality is that understanding cancer cannot result from the view on a single cancer event, but must consider the combined action of all cellular triggers in a given cellular background. There's little doubt in the scientific community that the high rate of carbohydrate ingestion contributes to various metabolic diseases, including the development of aggressive cancer. You see, the medical establishment may be missing the connection between sugar and its role in tumor genesis. Consider the million-dollar positive emission tomography device or a PET scan, regarded as one of the ultimate cancer detection tools. PET scans use radioactively labeled glucose to detect sugar-hungry tumor cells. PET scans are used to plot the progress of cancer patients and to assess whether present protocols are effective. So now we get domestic animals, cats, dogs, etc. They usually consume Western diets with a comparatively high glycemic index. They frequently suffer from aggressive cancer, whereas carnivore animals and herbivore animals do have a low rate of metastasizing cancer and rarely die from said disease. Both carnivores and herbivores predominantly live from proteins and fat and oil, and although herbivores ingest large amounts of complex carbohydrates, cellulose, and other fibers, these are fermented to fatty acids by bacteria within the gastrointestinal tract, and therefore exhibit an extremely low glycemic index. Limited release or even absence of glucose during digestion may explain the low rates of cancer-caused mortality in herbivore and carnivore animals. Number four, fact number four, sugar feeds cancer, certainly goes on. They talk a little bit about what goes on in Europe. They talk about a four-year study at the National Institute of Public Health and Environmental Protection in the Netherlands, comparing 111 biliary tract cancer patients with 480 controls. There's so much more with this. Let me give you the headline for fact number five. Conventional cancer treatment kills more than it cures. Of course, the cancer industry claims that that is a myth. The medical community insists that surgery is still the most effective treatment we have for cancer. Radiotherapy helps cure more people than cancer drugs, and yet chemotherapy and other cancer drugs have a very important part to play in cancer treatment. In some cases, helping to cure the disease, and in others, helping to prolong survival. Chemotherapy does not encourage cancer. Let me tell you something, my friends. I will be sitting in at for 2 hours next Tuesday night. And I am totally blanking on the time slot. Normally I go on at 8 Eastern time. I'll be going on at, what is that? Am I going on at 5 Eastern time? 6. Okay. All right. So we're doing another 2 hour set this coming Tuesday. And I'm going to tell you right now what we're going to be discussing for that entire 2 hours. Cancer. Chemotherapy. All the dangers, all the insanity that's going on. Keep this in mind. Here's the reality of conventional cancer treatment killing more than it cures. Doctors and pharmaceutical companies make money from it. That's the only reason chemotherapy is still used. Not because it's effective or decreases morbidity or mortality or diminishes any specific cancer rates. In fact, it does exactly the opposite. Chemotherapy boosts cancer growth and long-term mortality rates. Most chemo patients either die or are plagued with illness within 10 to 15 years after treatment, if they even live that long. It destroys their immune system, increases neurocognitive decline, disrupts their endocrine functioning, and causes organ and metabolic toxicities. Patients basically live in a permanent state of disease until their death. And the reason a five-year relative survival rate is the standard used to assess mortality rates is due to the fact that most cancer patients going downhill after this period. It's exceptionally bad for business, and the cancer industry knows it. They can never show the public the true 97% statistical failure rate in treating long-term metastatic cancers. If they did, published the long-term statistics for all cancer administered cytotoxic chemotherapy. That is, the 10-plus years to produce the objective data on rigorous evaluations, including the cost effectiveness, the impact on the immune system, the quality of life, morbidity and mortality. It would be very clear to the world that chemotherapy makes little to no contribution to cancer survival whatsoever. And no such study's ever been conducted by independent investigators in the history of chemotherapy. The only studies available come from industry-funded institutions and scientists, and none of them have ever conclusively quantified any of these variables. Why? Money, greed, and profits run the cancer industry. Not another damn thing. The cancer establishment must retreat from the truth to treat cancer, because there will never be any profit for them in eradicating the disease. There's no governing body in the world that protects consumers from being subjected to these toxic therapies or even known carcinogens in our foods, our environment, because that too will prevent the profits from rolling in. My friends, it's a business of mammoth proportions and must be treated as such. I will close in my final statement by sharing this. A series of studies, Annals of Oncology, another study in the American Society of Clinical Oncology, all determine whether long-time survivors of metastatic testicular cancer had an increased risk of cardiovascular morbidity more than 10 years after chemo. They observed a significantly increased risk for occurrence of cardiac events accompanied by a persisting unfavorable cardiovascular risk profile, likely due to chemotherapeutic agents. And another 12-year meta-analysis published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology observed that adults who had developed cancer and were treated with chemotherapy, and that 12-year study looked at adults who had developed cancer as an adult, 97% of the time chemotherapy did not work, regressing the metastatic cancers. I published this article December 8th, 2015, written by Dave Mihalovic. It is profound. I know I had to speed up the presentation. The article is available right now at drkelly.net. It's on the front page, called Five Cancer Facts That Big Pharma Is Now Aggressively Claiming Are Myths. And I promise you, my friends, there's not been one damn bit of change since this publication was made in December of 2015. I thank you for tolerating me tonight. This has been a very high-end program to do. It's one that I put a lot of effort into developing and pulling the right things together. I hope that it gives you some thoughts, some ideas. I pray you're not a cancer victim. Once again, go to drkelly.net. That's drkelly.net. Go to the bookstore. If you do nothing else, just for the knowledge of what you will gain, order a copy of Dr. Kelly's book, Victory Over Cancer Without Surgery, Chemotherapy, or Radiation. If you're interested in the self-test book, you can order them through PayPal. You can mail me a check. Give me a call, 602-799-8214. More than happy to help you. Time to go. As is always on this program, with glass lifted on high, my friends, I wish to health with you. Good night. It brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It
it brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars, and down by the shore an orchestra's playing, and even the when they begin the beginning. To live it again is past all endeavor, except when that tune clutches my heart. Divine, what rapture serene, till clouds came along to disperse the joys we had tasted. And now when I hear people curse the chance that was wasted, I know but too well what they mean.
Standing 6'4", weighing in 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science-analyzing brawn, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian, and my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. Fuck you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be the bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show. Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
You're listening to Real Talk Radio. Only on the Republic Broadcasting Network.